Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, new reports on the suspects in Tuesday's terrorist attacks in Brussels. Investigators say debris recovered on Mozambique is almost certainly from the ill-fated Malaysian Airlines MH370. We hear about two possibly life-saving devices being developed for patients.
They can monitor their own health, and they can also get the results very quickly to make some decisions on their own health.
And a pioneer of hip-hop, lyricist Fife Dawg, has died. It's right here on The Voice of America. The European Union is holding emergency talks on a response to the terror attacks on Brussels, where it is seated. A series of explosions at the airport and a subway station left at least 31 people dead and 300 others wounded. Correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Brussels and joins us on the line. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you, Susan.
What might these terrorist attacks mean for the future of the EU?
These attacks hold lots of challenges for the future of the EU. And as you said, there's going to be an emergency meeting this afternoon here in Brussels. But nobody expects them to completely come up with a plan to fix the problems ahead in one day. These attacks highlight some of the security problems in the European Union, which is very controversial because the European Union prides itself in free and open borders in between lots of countries. And a lot of people are now questioning the wisdom of this, and some countries are imposing border controls while the European Commission is saying that they should not. But obviously, each country has the right to do what they want within their own borders. So that's one problem. It also highlights some of the problems connected to the migrant crisis. More than 1 million people came to Europe last year. And so while lots more people are trying to get in now, a lot of European countries are struggling to take care of and integrate the people who are already here. Another major problem connected to both of these is the rise of nationalist movements in several European countries, and that's largely on anti-immigration platforms. What the right-wing nationalist movements will say is that bringing in refugees and migrants is bringing in terrorism. I'd like to say that there's actually not been any of these accused terrorists that are also known to be refugees. However, the connection is made in the public frequently, whether it's correct or incorrect. And both the victims of the attacks and the refugees are, in fact, running from the same thing, namely militants in the Middle East. So those are some of the things that the European Union will be talking about this afternoon and hopefully coming up with some answers and some agreements of how to move forward.
Now, authorities have found out some more about these terror suspects.
Yes, they have now four suspects that they're looking at. Two are suicide bombers that were killed, one at the airport, one in the metro station in the bombings on Tuesday. They're also looking at a man named Najim Lashraoui, who is believed to have been possibly a weapons expert and possibly the weapons expert that was involved in the Paris attacks in November 2015. There's also another attacker that they're searching for. If you recall, there was a picture online, three in the airport that are believed to have been involved in the attack. Two of them have been identified as brothers and suicide bombers, and one, a man with a hat, has not been identified, but he is believed to have been the second bomber in the airport.
And what is the feeling in Brussels today?
Well, things are starting to, on the surface, go back to normal. I mean, people are going back to work. The train station's opening, although there's heavy security measures in place. But there's just a sense of sadness and of anger and wondering what's next. How are we going to move beyond this?
Well, thank you very much, Heather. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today concerning this story. And joining me with the details is social media reporter Andrew Palcheski. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you for having me. Well, we're continuing to see tributes pour in for the people of Brussels after this attack. And we're seeing some really touching photos from around the world of buildings being lit up with the Belgian flag. For example, the Eiffel Tower lit up in the black, yellow, and red. We saw the top spire of One World Trade Center in New York with those same colors. And at LAX, Los Angeles International Airport here in the United States, those same colors in the entranceway to that airport lit up as a homage to the attack at the airport. So a lot of nice tributes pouring in via social media, people sharing those photos. Another image making its way around social media of Tintin, the beloved cartoon character, Belgian, of course, a picture of him holding up a newspaper and saying, "My goodness," in French, and crying as it says, "Attacks on Brussels." So very touching tributes pouring in and being shared across social media.
Are people still tweeting about this heavily like they were the first couple days?
It's tapered off some. It's actually shifted. You know, when you first have the attack, there's a lot of information sharing that goes on, and then it kind of shifts to now looking at the suspects and the investigation. But there was actually an interesting graphic that the Washington Post used where they tracked kind of a heat map of how many tweets were going out about Brussels. And you see the attacks were about 3 or 4 in the morning East Coast time here in the U.S., and by 7 or 8 a.m. East Coast, when everybody was starting to wake up, that's when you see that was the peak hour. So it actually took a couple hours to kind of build up and go around the world, but that was the point at which it most people were tweeting about it, so it was interesting to see that.
Have you seen any official tweets about what's going on, maybe to look out for the suspects?
I did see a tweet, actually, from the, I believe it was from the Prime Minister, who was encouraging people in the immediate aftermath to take to social media to contact loved ones because the cell networks were so taxed. He said, go to Facebook and Twitter, use those tools to try to contact your loved ones. So it was a unique kind of request that he put out saying, go to social media, don't tax the cell networks, especially as they're trying to get them back up and maybe first responders are trying to use those.
It's great we have this kind of technology.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Earth's auroras, Borealis in the northern polar region and Australis in the south, are among the most beautiful and haunting light displays in nature. Now, for the first time, scientists have been able to study Jupiter's auroras in X-ray wavelengths thanks to NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory. Auroras, both on Earth and on Jupiter, are triggered by high-charged solar particles blasting their way through the solar system and into the magnetic fields of the planets. But scientists have found that Jupiter's aurora, generated by a giant interplanetary coronal mass ejection, happened to be 8 times brighter and have hundreds times the energy than Earth's aurora. The study of Jupiter's aurora comes just months before NASA's Juno spacecraft is set to arrive at the planet. The Juno mission will study Jupiter's makeup, gravity field, magnetic field or magnetosphere, and its relationship with the solar wind. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Investigators today said debris recovered on the beaches of Mozambique is almost certainly from the ill-fated Malaysian Airlines MH370 Boeing 777, which disappeared after lifting off from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing March 8, 2014. 239 people, mostly Chinese, were on board. A wide-ranging search has focused on the southern Indian Ocean, far off course of the plane's flight path. Lee Ao Tong Lai is Malaysia's transport minister.
The two pieces of debris belong to Boeing 777 parts. Secondly, from the paint and stencil of these two pieces, it is similar to Mars Airlines paint and also that we concluded is most certain belong to MH370. And I'm looking from the drifting pattern that we have studied so far, it's confirmed that the plane ended in South Indian Ocean, and this debris followed the drifting pattern.
The examination of the debris involved an international team from Australia, Malaysia, and the U.S. manufacturer Boeing. Last year, a wing part called a flapperon was found on the Indian Ocean island of Reunion. Another potential piece of debris was recovered on a South African beach in Western Cape Province Tuesday. These discoveries are expected to add pressure to continue an expensive Australian-led search that is focused on 120,000 square kilometers of seafloor. Malaysian analyst James Chin of the University of Tasmania in Australia was asked by VOA's Victor Beattie, what makes these investigators so certain This is the debris from MH370.
I think based on the records kept by the Boeing company, they were saying that apparently there's only one 777 missing in the world today. So any parts pickup that is from a 777 is very likely to be the missing MH370.
We understand another piece has been found recently by a South African archaeologist on a beach.
Yes. So this is widely expected. With the wave flowing towards the African coast, many people are expecting many more parts will show up in the coming months. So it's really an issue of the Australian-led discovery team to carry on searching in that area for the big parts.
What will these pieces tell people about the fate of the plane?
I think that most people around the world, including the families, realize that the plane did crash somewhere into the deep ocean and that there are no survivors left.
Now, will there be any clues in addition to this debris found? Obviously, the flight data recorders are probably beyond retrieval at this point or useless at this point.
It is my understanding that if they do eventually find the flight recorder, even though that the battery has run out, it is still possible to recover the actual tape recording of the flight.
But that's like finding a needle in a haystack.
Yes, but the point is that now that they know roughly where the plane has gone down, the chances of finding the big parts are a lot greater compared to the search operation that's been going on for the past 2 years.
Now, Malaysia on Thursday also said a coastal search needs to be undertaken around South Africa and Mozambique for further potential debris from that jetliner. Where are people searching now?
Right now, the search operation is actually not off the coast of South Africa. It's actually towards Reunion Island. The problem is that the latest report coming out of Australia says that the search has been halted because they lost one of the important parts. I think it's called the underwater submarine. There's something wrong with that part, so they can't do the search now. My understanding is that the search will resume over the next few weeks, and they might move the search closer to the South African coast. But again, this will depend very much on what they plan to do.
Well, there had been some talk that the search will be called off by mid-year.
My understanding is that the search operation has been budgeted to until the middle of this year. But now with more pieces coming up along the coast of South Africa, I expect the Malaysian and the Australian government to put in some more money so that the search can be carried on.
James Chin says it appears now almost certainly that the plane did crash violently, way off course, and there are no survivors. But analysts say only by locating the crash site and recovering the black box will authorities ever hope to solve one of aviation's mysteries. Coming up on International Edition, possible medical devices of the future. And we look at the contribution of a pioneer of hip-hop. It can be a matter of life or death, waiting for test results from a laboratory concerning a serious health problem. But two small medical devices now in development can quickly diagnose some conditions, including the possibility of a heart attack. Reporter Deborah Block is following this story and joins us on the line. Welcome, Deborah.
Thanks very much, Susan.
So, what can you tell us about the first device?
Well, the first device has a great name, first of all. It's called a tricorder. That was the same name as the fictional medical scanner that was used in the Star Trek TV series.
Yeah, Dr. McCoy had one.
Right. What's that?
Dr. McCoy had one.
That's right, Dr. McCoy. And, I mean, what was great about that, as I always said, I wish I had one of these now, is that little thing would go over the body, and they might be in terrible pain, and all of a sudden they would just jump off the table and be fine. Well, this group that's come up with this real-world tricorder can diagnose some diseases, can't go as far as the Star Trek one, but this one will be able to test blood, urine, and saliva samples. There's a small chip in this handheld device that contains a complex liquid network that can test those fluids. And then those diagnostic results are actually forwarded to a smartphone app. And the inventor of this tricorder, who is a professor of biomedical engineering at George Washington University here in Washington, D.C., says the goal of this device is potentially to put it in a to get the results in a physician's office or even in your own home or both or a hospital. And what this means is that you can get these results within hours, if not minutes. And as you mentioned, the rapid response could alert someone of an impending heart attack or perhaps diagnose other serious health problems. And the tricorder, the inventor hopes, will also be used in the future to test for infectious diseases.
And the second device, how does it work?
I love the second invention because it's worn like a piece of jewelry on your finger. It's a flexible ring that's embedded with a wireless echocardiogram sensor that can diagnose heart irregularities as well as other conditions. And like the tricorder, the results can be delivered to a phone app anywhere, such as your home or to your doctor. What's great about both these devices, Susan, is that the patient can actually use these in their own home. They don't need somebody there to help them do this. So they can monitor their own health, and they can also get the results very quickly to make some decisions on their own health.
Well, when might these be available?
Well, the hope is that these diagnostic tools will be in the hands of doctors and patients within just a few years. And if that happens, it'll be interesting to see what people think about using them, because there are some people who don't like putting sensors on their bodies, which is understandable. It's something we're not used to. But for people who have chronic conditions, you know, who are at risk of, you know, as we mentioned, a heart attack or some other serious problem, these devices could be useful and life-saving. They also, besides cutting the time of the results, they might cut costs because there's not a full-size laboratory involved. And, of course, hopefully save a lot of lives.
And also, privacy is an issue. People using this in their own home could maintain their privacy.
That's absolutely right. They sure could.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
From Science and Technology, here's what's new.
What's new? Nike's laceless athletic shoes with the awkward name HyperAdapt 1.0. Nike says the new shoe is powered by an underfoot lacing mechanism. Think tiny motor that runs on a battery that needs charging every couple of weeks. When your heel hits a sensor in the bottom of the shoe, the laces tighten. You manually control the fit by pressing a plus or minus button on the top of the shoe. Nike claims the shoe will provide precise, consistent, personalized lockdown for the wearer, adding that the fit can be manually adjusted on the go. The new shoes won't be available until later this year, and the company says the HyperAdapt 1.0 will be sold only to members of the company's Nike Plus app service, which gets decidedly mixed reviews. Just Google it. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Rosans.
A pioneer of hip-hop, lyricist Fife Dawg of a tribe called Quest has died. Dawg, born Malik Isaac Taylor, died Tuesday from complications of diabetes, according to a family statement. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host about the life and contributions of Fife Dawg.
Yeah, it is a tragedy, and he was a master lyricist, and he was sort of the fun one of a tribe called Quest. The tribe, of course, Q-Tip, Ali Shaheed Muhammad, and Fife Dawg, and he'll say something, and you're like, oh, I can't believe he just said that. Did he really just say that? That was so funny. That was so clever. He was a clever guy, but unfortunately, he was suffering from type 1 diabetes, and it was well known, and we got to see this in 2001. There was a movie called Beats, Rhymes, and Life, about Tribe Called Quest. And we got to see in that movie that although he was aware that he had diabetes and that he was supposed to take care of himself in a certain way, he, you know, he enjoyed life. And unfortunately, that included some foods and things that one with diabetes shouldn't. A lot of sugar, things like that. So he was ill during the filming of the movie, and he had to have a kidney replaced, I believe, and it was kind of, unfortunately, downhill from there as far as his health was concerned.
Now, what would you say was his main contribution to hip-hop from Quest and, you know, from his lyrics? Did other people, because there's other Machine Gun lyricists, Eminem comes to my mind, but they pull things and you have to sit down with a piece of paper and read the lyrics and go, wait a minute, did he really? Is that because of Fife? Was he like a pioneer in that way?
Well, I don't know that I would consider Fife to be a machine gun lyricist necessarily. I mean, he didn't have that really super fast delivery. He was clever. You know, when I think of a Kanye West, for example, I'm like, okay, Kanye obviously, and I'm talking about early Kanye West here, obviously was influenced by Fife Dawg, because Fife, again, would put things, I mean, he called himself the 5-foot assassin. And I mean, there are lyrics, I don't know that I can repeat them here on the air, but because some of them were, you know, a little risque.
Right.
But again, just to hear these things come out of his mouth, they you would stop. You would think to yourself, number one, he is such a lyricist. He really has this interesting command of the English language. And number two, he does it kind of in jest. Like he didn't take himself very seriously. At least it didn't appear that he did lyrically. I'm sure as a lyricist, we know as a lyricist, as a hip hop artist, he took himself seriously. And Tribe Called Quest, they provided the soundtrack for a generation. If you were coming up in the early 90s or the mid 90s and you were a hip hop fan, even if you were a pop music fan, because they began to kind of move into that arena as well, you were familiar with at least one song. You had at least heard Bonita Applebum if you had heard nothing else. And with Fife and then Q-Tip's production, because Q-Tip is a phenomenal producer, and he would always take these really sort of eccentric, kind of off the wall samples and create masterpieces out of them. That is the contribution, I think, that Fife and then the group Tribe Called Quest made to hip hop.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. And don't forget our website, voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 24th each year, nations around the globe observe World Tuberculosis Day, commemorating Dr. Robert Koch's 1882 discovery of Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the bacteria that caused the disease. The observance is designed to build public awareness about the global epidemic of tuberculosis. Tuberculosis, or TB, is the second leading cause of death from infectious diseases worldwide, infecting almost 9 million people and killing some 1.5 million. Prior to the advent of antibiotics in the 1940s, TB was one of the most feared diseases around. Today, the majority of TB deaths occur in the developing world, where the disease is closely linked to poverty, marginalized and vulnerable populations, substandard housing, and poor nutrition. This year's theme, 2016, Unite to End TB, aims to advance the United Nations goal of ending the epidemic by the year 2030. The idea is to promote collaboration and communication among various concerned groups and individuals across sectors and disciplines of every sort, so they can exchange ideas and utilize their expertise to eliminate some of the obstacles that need to be overcome if we are to succeed. This means that, as part of the campaign to vanquish TB, we must do our best to eliminate poverty, which helps sustain the epidemic. We must find better, more efficient ways to test for the disease and to treat and cure those who are found to suffer from it. We must find a way to end the stigmatization of the victims of tuberculosis and end discriminatory practices against them. And we must find new ways to attack the disease and its attendant problems. The United States is committed to fighting tuberculosis. In focusing our efforts in countries where the burden of TB is highest, we support programs that save lives and foster a more secure world. Across the federal government, we have made this fight a priority. We continue to partner with the World Health Organization, or WHO, the Stop TB Partnership, and the Global Drug Facility, to provide important support for TB control activities worldwide and achieve the world's vision with the adoption of the Sustainable Development Goals. By joining in a global commitment to stop the spread of TB, we can begin to free a new generation from an ancient affliction.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.